Hey, I'm Alex.
And I'm Sam. Welcome to BS Killer Book Autopsy.
In 2012, a Nobel Prize winner wrote an open letter to his own field, warning them of what he called a train wreck.
He was talking about his own book.
1 year after publishing the most cited psychology book of the decade, he publicly said the research in Chapter 4 was heading for collapse.
5 years later, he went further. 2017, interview with Retraction Watch. Direct quote, I placed too much faith in underpowered studies.
The book was never revised, never updated, never corrected. Daniel Kahneman died in March 2024, age 90.
So we did it for him. We autopsied all 38 chapters from the primary text, 44 autopsies total. Every study checked against the replication record, every quote verified verbatim.
The scorecard? 6 major claims are dead, 5 are wounded, 17 plus survived, including the work that won the Nobel Prize.
Quick scores. BS, 5 out of 10. This is a book where some chapters score a 2 and others score an 8. Edge, 8.5. More useful ideas per page than anything else we've autopsied. Replicability, 6 out of 10. Conditional. You need a field guide to tell which findings survived and which didn't.
That's what this episode is.
Here's the next hour. The man and his partner. The framework everyone gets wrong. The 6 dead studies and why they died. The ideas that actually survived and will change how you think. And what Kahneman got right that nobody else has. Let's go.
This is not the story of one man. This is the story of two.
Daniel Kahneman, born Tel Aviv, 1934, survived the Nazi occupation of France as a child. His father was a research chemist for L'Oréal, who was picked up in a roundup of French Jews in 1942, got released through his employer's intervention, died of untreated diabetes in 1944.
So by age 10, Kahneman had already learned that the world is not predictable and authority figures can be dead wrong.
He became a psychologist, ended up at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and in 1969, he asked a colleague to give a guest lecture in his seminar.
Amos Tversky.
Many people who knew Amos thought he was the most intelligent person they had ever met. That's a direct quote from the book's introduction. And there's a famous joke in psychology, the Tversky intelligence test.
Which is?
The faster you realized Tversky was smarter than you, the smarter you were.
That's brutal.
They clicked immediately, started meeting at Café Ramon in Jerusalem. The book says they spent most of their working days together for the next 14 years, often on long walks. And the work they did together was, quote, the best either of us ever did.
But here's the thing the book buries. This was not an equal partnership in the eyes of the world.
Tversky got the MacArthur Genius Grant, alone. Their collaboration produced joint papers, but the academic world assumed Tversky was the real brains. Kahneman has written about this pain.
And then it got worse. Tversky was diagnosed with metastatic melanoma in 1993, told nobody outside his family for 2 years, continued publishing, died June 2, 1996, age 59.
6 years later, Kahneman won the Nobel Prize in economics, 2002. He couldn't share it because the Nobel is not awarded posthumously.
Tversky is Kahneman's Nancy.
For listeners who missed episode 1, the Nancy question is our term for the person who did the invisible work. In Poor Charlie's Almanac, it was Munger's first wife, Nancy Huggins, who got 3 sentences in a 600-page book.
Here, it's worse. Tversky didn't get 3 sentences. He got plenty of sentences. He got the whole introduction, but he didn't get the prize. And he didn't get to co-author the book that made their ideas famous.
Kahneman has been very explicit about this. He said the ideas in this book belong to both of them, but only one name is on the cover because only one of them was alive.
One more thing about Kahneman, the ending. March 27, 2024, age 90. Kahneman chose assisted suicide in Switzerland through Pegasos. His wife Anne Treisman had suffered vascular dementia before her own death in 2018. The day before, he sent a goodbye email to friends. Quote, this is a goodbye letter. I am sending friends to tell them that I am on my way to Switzerland, where my life will end on March 27th. A man who spent his entire career studying how humans make irrational decisions made his final decision with complete rationality.
And then the obituaries all praised his intellectual honesty because he was the psychologist who stood up and said his own research was wrong. How many scientists do that?
And here's something else the book doesn't tell you, the narrative fallacy chapter, chapter 19. Kahneman credits Nassim Taleb for coining the term narrative fallacy. stories that feel inevitable after the fact. The Google origin story. The founders tried to sell for under $1 million. The buyer said the price was too high. And the book points out that mentioning the single lucky incident actually makes it easier to underestimate the multitude of ways in which luck affected the outcome.
But here's the irony. The story of Kahneman and Tversky in the introduction is itself a narrative fallacy. Two brilliant minds meet at a seminar and change the world. It feels inevitable. But if Kahneman hadn't happened to invite Tversky to that seminar in 1969, if the conversation hadn't clicked over lunch at Café Ramon, prospect theory might never have existed.
The man who warned you about narrative fallacies opened his book with the best narrative fallacy in psychology.
And it's a great story. That's the problem. The better the story, the harder it is to see the luck.
All right, let's talk about what he actually wrote. The framework first.
Two systems, System 1 and System 2. Fast and slow. This is the title of the book and the idea that everyone knows.
And everyone gets it wrong. Page 29. Direct quote. These are fictitious characters. He says it right there. They're not brain regions, they're not modules, they're shorthand, like calling your impulses one name and your reasoning another.
He literally says, a sentence is understood more easily if it describes what an agent does than what something is. So System 1 and System 2 are a storytelling device.
But here's what's real behind the fiction. System 1 is fast, automatic, runs all the time. It's what makes you flinch at a loud noise or read the emotion on a face in milliseconds. System 2 is slow, deliberate, effortful. It's what you use for long division or parallel parking.
And the key insight is that System 2 is lazy.
Incredibly lazy. It will accept whatever System 1 serves up, unless something triggers it to engage. And engaging System 2 is physically effortful. Your pupils dilate, your heart rate increases. Kahneman describes walking his daily 4 miles in the Berkeley Hills. At 17 minutes per mile, he can think freely. At 14 minutes per mile, nothing. Brain shuts down. But the framework's real power is one concept, YCIT.
What you see is all there is. This is rated in our autopsy as the single most useful concept in the entire book. And it survived replication.
Explain it.
Your brain builds the best possible story from whatever information is available. It does not notice what's missing. It does not flag gaps. It does not say, hey, maybe there's a whole other side to this. It just builds the story.
And then you feel confident about it.
Extremely confident, because the story is coherent, and coherence feels like truth. The book says it perfectly. Only one interpretation came to mind, and you were never aware of the ambiguity. System 1 does not keep track of alternatives that it rejects, or even of the fact that there were alternatives. Conscious doubt is not in the repertoire.
That's terrifying.
Want to experience it? Right now.
Go.
A bat and a ball cost $1.10 in total. The bat costs a dollar more than the ball. How much does the ball cost?
10 cents. Wait.
You just did it. Everyone does it. The answer is 5 cents. The bat costs $1.05. The ball costs 5 cents. $1.05 plus 5 cents equals $1.10. But your System 1 screamed 10 cents, and you nearly went with it.
Over 50% of students at Harvard, MIT, and Princeton get that wrong.
Over 50%. At the best universities in the world. Because System 1 generates an answer that feels right, and System 2 doesn't bother to check.
And there's another test, Steve.
Oh, Steve. This is from chapter 15, but it illustrates Wisiati perfectly. Steve is described as very shy and withdrawn, invariably helpful, but with little interest in people or the world of reality. A meek and tidy soul, he has a need for order and structure and a passion for detail. Is Steve more likely to be a librarian or a farmer?
Everyone says librarian.
Everyone says librarian. But there are roughly 20 times more male farmers than male librarians in the United States. Even if every single librarian matched that description perfectly, the base rate alone makes farmer far more likely. But your System 1 doesn't do base rates. It does resemblance. Steve sounds like a librarian, therefore he is a librarian. Wisiati.
You see the information that's presented. You don't see the information that's missing.
And you never notice it's missing. That's the terrifying part. Your confidence in the librarian answer feels identical to confidence based on actual evidence. The feeling of knowing and the fact of knowing are completely disconnected. So the framework is a fiction that describes something real.
Exactly. The systems aren't real. The laziness is real. The wisiati is real. The confidence is real. And that's what makes this book both brilliant and dangerous. Because Kahneman uses his own framework brilliantly in part one, and then in chapters 3 and 4, he falls victim to exactly the biases he's describing.
He saw studies with dramatic results and small samples, and his system one said, yes, this is real.
And his System 2 didn't check.
A book about cognitive biases written by a man experiencing cognitive biases. You couldn't script this.
All right, the replication crisis. This is the section that makes this episode different from every other podcast about this book.
Because nobody else does the autopsy.
Nobody else goes claim by claim with the actual replication papers. So let's do it. 6 dead, 5 wounded, and then the 17 that survived.
Start with the dead.
Number 1, the Florida effect. Chapter 4. This is the most famous priming study ever published.
Students unscrambled sentences with words like Florida and bald and wrinkle. Then they walked down a hallway more slowly.
John Barg, 1996, 2,000 plus citations. Kahneman presents it as established science.
Doyen and colleagues tried to replicate in 2012, published in PLOS One. 120 participants this time with automated timing. No effect. Zero. And in a second experiment, they showed the effect only appeared when the experimenters knew which condition the students were in.
So the experimenters were unconsciously changing their measurements.
Experimenter expectancy bias, not priming. And Barg's response was revealing. He wrote a scathing blog post attacking Doyen, then deleted it. Ed Young at National Geographic documented the whole thing before it vanished.
So the first domino falls. What's next?
Number 2. Money priming, also chapter 4. Kathleen Voss, published in Science 2006. 9 experiments claiming that exposure to money-related words made people more selfish and less helpful. Kahneman calls her laudably restrained.
Laudably restrained? For a finding that doesn't exist?
Rohrer, Poschler, and Harris ran 4 experiments in 2015, effect size near zero. And then it turned out Voss had 19 additional measures that showed no effects that were never reported in the original paper. Science published an erratum in 2015, correcting multiple technical errors.
19 unreported null measures? You run 20 measurements and only report the one that works? That's not science. That's cherry picking.
Number 3, the pencil in mouth study. Not in chapter 4, but related. Hold a pencil between your teeth to force a smile. Cartoons become funnier. Hold it with your lips to force a frown, they don't.
I've seen that cited in literally every psychology course.
Wagenmachers and colleagues, 2016, registered replication report, 17 labs, 1,894 participants. The difference in funniness ratings between the smile and frown conditions, 0.03 on a 10-point scale. The original found 0.82.
From 0.82 to 0.03?
Across 17 labs, all pre-registered. The effect is gone. That's not a replication failure. That's an extinction event.
Number 4?
Ego depletion. Chapter 3. Roy Baumeister's work. The idea that willpower is a depletable resource, like a muscle that gets tired. You resist one temptation, and you have less willpower for the next one.
And the book presents this really compellingly, the chocolate chip cookie experiment. Students sit in a room with fresh-baked cookies and radishes. Half are told to eat only the radishes. Then everyone does an impossible puzzle.
The radish resistors gave up after 8 minutes. The cookie eaters lasted 19 minutes. Kahneman says this is conclusively demonstrated.
Conclusively is a dangerous word.
Hager and colleagues, 2016, 23 labs, 2,141 participants. Effect size D equals 0.04. The original was D equals 0.62.
0.04?
Essentially zero. And it gets worse. The glucose model. Chapter 3 also presents the idea that drinking lemonade with real sugar restores your willpower, while artificial sweetener doesn't. Kahneman writes about this like it's settled science.
I believed that one. I actually bought lemonade before exams.
Vedenlo Gold and Osman ran a meta-analysis in 2016. No evidence that blood glucose affects self-control. The brain uses about 20% of your body's glucose at all times, regardless of what you're thinking about. The marginal cost of effortful thinking is negligible. You cannot drink your way to willpower.
So the chapter on self-control has no self-control over its own claims?
that's exactly right.
So that's four dead. What are five and six?
Five, the disfluency effect. Chapter 5. Hard-to-read fonts make you think more carefully. Demon, Yaman, and colleagues published the original study in 2011, claiming dramatic improvements in test scores just by switching to a harder-to-read font.
Wait, from changing a font?
Shi, Zhou, and Liu ran a meta-analysis in 2018. 25 studies, effect size essentially zero, and some replications found fonts that were hard to read actually made people perform worse.
So the intervention does the opposite of what was claimed. Love it.
And six, the Lady Macbeth effect. The claim that people who lied on the phone preferred mouthwash over soap, and people who lied in email preferred soap over mouthwash. Body part specificity of moral cleansing. Not independently replicated.
So six dead, all concentrated in chapters 3, 4, and 5, part one of the book.
And here's the pattern. Every dead study came from a specific era of social psychology, roughly 2000 to 2010. Small samples, dramatic effect sizes, published in top journals, no replication requirements, and when the replication crisis hit, they all collapsed.
Kahneman was citing the best available evidence at the time.
He was, and that's the tragedy. He wasn't being careless, he was being mainstream.
What about the wounded? Not dead, but damaged.
Five claims. First, the Israeli judges study. Parole approval rates spike to 65% after meals and drop to 0% before meals. Kahneman presents this as ego depletion in action.
That was the most viral finding in the whole book. Every TED Talk cited it.
Turns out, the pattern is likely driven by case scheduling. Represented prisoners with lawyers get heard first after breaks. Unrepresented prisoners get heard last. The data is real, but the interpretation is almost certainly wrong.
So the judges aren't hangry, they're just processing easy cases first.
Which is such a perfect example of YCA. Everyone saw the meal timing correlation, and their system one built the most dramatic story. Hangry judges denying parole. Nobody looked for the boring explanation.
The boring explanation being case scheduling.
Always check for the boring explanation first. That should be a law.
What's wounded number two?
The marshmallow test. Walter Mischel. Kids who resisted eating a marshmallow for 15 minutes and waited for a second marshmallow did better in life. Higher SAT scores, lower BMI, better social adjustment.
This is the most famous experiment in all of psychology.
Watts, Duncan, and Kwan, 2018, reanalysis with a sample 10 times larger and better controls. Over 900 kids instead of Mischel's original 90 from the Stanford campus preschool. The effect largely disappeared once you controlled for socioeconomic status.
So the marshmallows were measuring wealth?
Rich kids can afford to wait. They already trust that the second marshmallow is coming because adults in their life have always delivered on promises. Poor kids grab what they can because that's the rational strategy when resources are scarce.
That's not a lack of willpower. That's good decision-making under uncertainty.
Exactly. The reframe changes everything. Number three, the endowment effect. People demand more to give up something they own than they'd pay to acquire it. The classic finding is you'll sell your coffee mug for $7, but only buy one for $3.
And that's wounded? Moore, Wedge, and Giblin, 2015, showed it's partially driven by transaction costs and experimental design. It's real, but smaller and more conditional than the book presents, not the universal law it's sold as.
Four? The $75,000 happiness threshold, chapter 37. This is the one that went nuclear in every personal finance article. Below 75K, happiness increases with income. Above it, experienced well-being flatlines. Zero additional happiness from more money.
That's been quoted in every personal finance article since 2010.
Matthew Killingsworth challenged it in 2021. Then, Killingsworth and Kahneman ran an adversarial collaboration, published 2023. The finding? Happiness does continue to rise with income for most people. But for the unhappiest 20%, it flatlines around $75 to $100K. So Kahneman was right about the miserable, wrong about everyone else.
And five?
The honesty box with eyes. Putting a picture of eyes near an honesty box increases contributions. Early studies showed dramatic effects. Larger replications found small or null effects. It probably works sometimes in some context, but it's not the reliable nudge it was sold as.
So six dead, five wounded, and now the survivors.
This is where the book earns its 8.5 edge score, because what survived is genuinely important.
Start with the crown jewel.
Prospect theory, chapters 25 and 26, the work that won the Nobel Prize.
Replicated in 2020 in Nature Human Behavior. 4098 participants, 19 countries, 13 languages, 94% of items replicated. 12 out of 13 theoretical contrasts held.
That's about as solid as it gets in social science.
Rock solid. 45 plus years of replication, and the core insight is simple but devastating. Losses hurt roughly twice as much as equivalent gains feel good. You feel worse losing $100 than you feel good finding $100.
2-to-1 ratio?
The ratio itself has been refined. Gall and Rucker, 2018, in the Journal of Consumer Psychology, argued it's less robust and universal than assumed. Simonson and Kavetz rebutted in the same journal. Current consensus is the asymmetry is real, but the exact ratio varies by context. Maybe 1.5 to 1, maybe 2 to 1, maybe higher for things you love.
But the direction is always the same.
Always. Losses loom larger than gains, and it explains everything from why you won't sell a losing stock, to why contract negotiations stall, to why people stay in bad jobs. The pain of losing what you have feels bigger than the joy of getting something better. And this one connects to Munger.
Directly. Munger's deprival superreaction tendency. Same insight, different name. Munger arrived at it through business observation. Kahneman arrived at it through laboratory experiments. Same truth from two different angles.
What else survived?
Why Seattle? We already covered that. Anchoring, chapter 11, one of the most robust findings in all of judgment and decision making. Ask someone if Gandhi was more or less than 114 years old when he died, then ask them how old he was. They'll guess higher than if you'd anchored at 35.
Even though 114 is obviously absurd.
Even then, your answer shifts. You know it's absurd. Your system two knows it's absurd, but something in your system one latches onto that number and drags your estimate upward.
So the anchor doesn't have to be plausible.
It doesn't even have to be related. There's an experiment where they spin a rigged wheel of fortune in front of judges. Judges who saw the wheel land on 65 gave longer sentences than judges who saw it land on 10 for the same case.
That's judges, in courtrooms, making sentencing decisions influenced by a random number from a wheel?
Replicated across cultures, across paradigms, across procedures, bomb-proof.
The planning fallacy?
Chapter 23. And this is my favorite story in the entire book, because it happened to Kahneman himself. He's working with a team on a curriculum for teaching judgment and decision-making in high schools. They've been at it for about a year. He asks everyone to estimate how long it will take to finish.
Everyone says about 2 more years.
Right. Then he turns to Seymour Fox, curriculum expert, fellow on the team, and asks him how similar teams have taken to finish similar projects. Fox goes pale.
And says?
He's never realized this before, but 40% of teams like theirs never finish at all. And the ones that did took 7 to 10 years.
Wait, and they asked him to rate their own team?
He said they were below average. But not by much. So Kahneman has the base rate. He knows 40% chance of failure and 7 to 10 years of success. And what did they do?
Ignored it?
Completely ignored it. Continued with their original plan. The project took 8 years. The man who literally coined the term planning fallacy committed the planning fallacy while writing the paper on the planning fallacy.
System 2 is really lazy.
Spectacularly lazy. And the pre-mortem. This came from Gary Klein, Kahneman's collaborator. You gather your team and say, imagine we are a year into the future. We implemented the plan as it now exists. The outcome was a disaster.
take 5 to 10 minutes to write a brief history of that disaster. A CEO at Davos heard this and muttered, "It was worth coming to Davos just for this."
What about the Linda problem?
Oh, Linda, chapter 15, one of the best replicated findings in all of psychology. Linda is 31 years old, single, outspoken, and very bright. She majored in philosophy. As a student, she was deeply concerned with issues of discrimination and social justice and participated in anti-nuclear demonstrations. Which is more probable? A, Linda is a bank teller. B, Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement.
Everyone picks B.
Everyone picks B, and it's logically impossible for B to be more probable than A. The probability of two things both being true can never be higher than the probability of one of them being true. This is the conjunction fallacy. And here's the beautiful part. Kahneman says when they ran this at the University of British Columbia in the 1980s, the audience laughed.
Why?
Because they immediately knew Linda attended Berkeley. The description is a caricature of a Berkeley student in that era. Kahneman didn't even need to tell them. Everyone's System 1 built the story instantly.
What about when you can trust experts and when you can't?
Chapter 22. This one is gold because it came out of a 5-year adversarial collaboration between Kahneman and Gary Klein. Klein studied firefighters and emergency room doctors, people whose intuitions are incredible. Kahneman studied stock pickers and political pundits, people whose intuitions are garbage. They published a paper called Conditions for Intuitive Expertise, A Failure to Disagree.
Great title.
And they agreed on two conditions for when you can trust expert intuition. Condition one, the environment must be sufficiently regular to be predictable. Condition two, the expert must have had enough practice to learn those regularities. Firefighters, regular patterns, thousands of hours. Trust their gut. Stock pickers, random walk, no learnable patterns. Don't trust their gut.
And the book has an incredible example of why this matters.
The typhoid doctor, early 20th century physician who could predict typhoid by palpating patients' tongues. Amazing intuition, right? Except he never washed his hands between patients. He wasn't predicting typhoid, he was giving them typhoid. His predictions were accurate, but not because he was exercising professional intuition.
Oh, God. What about the framing effects?
Chapter 34, The Asian Disease Problem, also rock solid. 600 people are expected to die from an outbreak. Program A saves 200 people. Program B has a 1/3 probability of saving everyone and a 2/3 probability of saving nobody. Most people pick A, save 200 for sure.
Sounds reasonable.
Now, reframe it. Program C means 400 people will die. Program D has a 1/3 probability that nobody dies and a 2/3 probability that 600 die. Most people now pick D, the risky option.
Those are the same programs.
Exactly the same. A equals C, B equals D, just reframed from lives saved to lives lost. And that reframing completely reverses the majority choice. And the organ donation data. Austria has close to 100% organ donation, Germany 12%, Sweden 86%, Denmark 4%. The only difference, opt-out versus opt-in checkbox.
One checkbox.
One checkbox changes it from 4% to close to 100%.
And the peak end rule? Chapter 35. Your memory of an experience is dominated by two things, how you felt at the peak moment and how you felt at the end. Duration barely matters. The book has a thought experiment that gets everyone. Imagine the perfect vacation, but at the end, all your photos and videos are destroyed, and you swallow a drug that wipes all your memories of it. Would you still go?
Most people say no.
Most people say no, meaning they're not buying the experience, they're buying the memory. You are your remembering self, and the experiencing self who does your living is like a stranger to you.
That's one of the most unsettling sentences I've ever read.
And it replicated.
All right, 5 things. What do you actually take away from this book?
Number one, the YCIT checklist. Before any important decision, ask yourself, what information am I not seeing? What would change my mind if I knew it? Your brain will never volunteer this question on its own. Number two.
The outside view. Before you estimate how long something will take or how likely it is to succeed, find the base rate.
How long did similar projects take? What percentage succeeded? Then adjust from there, not the other way around.
Which is exactly what Kahneman failed to do when writing his own curriculum.
Exactly what he failed to do. Number three, algorithms beat experts in low-validity environments. If the environment is unpredictable, stock markets, long-range political forecasts, hiring decisions, use a checklist, use a formula, don't trust your gut.
Number four.
Peak and your experiences. If you're designing a customer experience or a medical procedure or even a vacation, the ending matters more than the middle. Make the ending good. Duration neglect means people won't remember the boring parts anyway.
And number five.
Reframe before you react. Whenever someone presents you with a decision, ask yourself, how would this look if framed differently? Am I reacting to the substance or to the frame? Losses are not the same as costs. 90% survival rate is not the same as 10% mortality rate. Same math, completely different gut reaction.
Now the BS. What's actually wrong with this book beyond the dead studies?
Three things. First, chapters 3 and 4 are obsolete. If you're reading this book in 2026, you should skip the priming and ego depletion chapters entirely. The author himself said they were wrong.
Second,
the System 1, System 2 framework is unfalsifiable. You cannot design an experiment that would prove it wrong. Any behavior can be explained by saying System 1 did it or System 2 failed to override. It's a useful metaphor, but it's not science in the Popperian sense.
And third?
Just so stories. Kahneman sometimes explains findings with evolutionary narratives. Our ancestors needed to detect threats quickly, so System 1 evolved to be fast but error-prone. These stories feel satisfying. They fit YCIT perfectly. And they're completely untestable.
So the man who wrote the book on why we find untestable narratives satisfying filled his book with untestable narratives.
And he knew it. That's the thing. Kahneman was more honest about the limitations of his own work than almost any other scientist alive. He just couldn't escape the biases he described.
Which might be the most important lesson in the whole book.
If the man who identified these biases couldn't overcome them, what chance do you have?
At least now you know they exist.
Cross-book time. How does this connect to episode 1?
Munger and Kahneman are 70% the same thinker.
Munger's 25 psychological tendencies, most of them map directly onto Kahneman's biases. Social proof tendency is anchoring plus YCIT. Reward and punishment super response tendency is prospect theory's loss aversion. Contrast misreaction tendency is Kahneman's reference point dependence.
But each one sees something the other misses.
Exactly. Munger sees incentives everywhere. His favorite question is always, show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcome. Kahneman barely discusses incentives. It's a blind spot.
And Kahneman sees regression to the mean, which Munger barely mentions.
The flight instructor story, chapter 17. Instructors praised cadets for good landings and criticized them for bad landings. After praise, performance got worse. After criticism, performance got better. So the instructors concluded that criticism works and praise doesn't.
But that's just regression to the mean.
Pure regression. An unusually good landing will be followed by a more average one, regardless of what you say to the pilot. An unusually bad landing will be followed by a more average one, regardless. The instructors were taking credit for a statistical inevitability. Kahneman calls this one of the most important lessons he ever learned, and Munger never discusses it.
And there's also the illusion of validity story from Kahneman's own life.
Oh, this one is devastating. Chapter 20, Young Kahneman in the Israeli Army. His job is to watch groups of soldiers doing leaderless challenges. 8 candidates hauling a long log over a 6-foot wall. He watches and he can see it. He can see the natural leader emerge. He can see who's a follower, who panics, who has grace under pressure.
And?
Follow-up data showed his predictions were barely better than chance, completely useless. And here's the killer line from the book. We knew that our predictions were little better than random guesses, but we continue to feel and act as if each prediction was valid. I termed the experience the illusion of validity.
He named the illusion after experiencing it himself and then kept experiencing it again?
He kept doing the evaluations, knowing they were useless, because they felt valid. System 1 generates confidence. System 2 can't override the feeling even when it knows the data says otherwise.
That might be the most honest thing any scientist has ever written about their own failure.
And then there's the Wall Street story, same chapter. Kahneman gets data from a wealth management firm, 25 advisors, 8 years of annual bonuses. If the advisors had real skill, their year-to-year rankings would be correlated. Good years would predict good years.
And?
The average correlation was 0.01, essentially zero. The rankings from year to year were random. The advisors were being rewarded for luck, and nobody in the firm knew it. Kahneman showed the data to the executives.
What happened?
Nothing. They nodded politely and went back to paying bonuses as if skill were real. He describes leaving the meeting feeling the data had made no impact at all.
YCID again. The narrative of skilled advisors was too coherent to disrupt with mere data.
So read both.
Read both. They're the same mind from different angles. And every biography has a Nancy.
In Munger's book, the Nancy was his first wife. Three sentences and then straight to real estate deals.
In Kahneman's book, the Nancy is Amos Tversky. He gets the whole introduction, he gets credit throughout, but he died 6 years before the Nobel, and he never got to co-author the book that made their joint ideas famous.
The man who taught us about loss aversion experienced the deepest loss of all, the death of his intellectual partner.
And then he wrote a book about how humans process loss, Medium.
Alone. One more thing on the Kahneman and Munger connection. The book has this line about marriage, chapter 38. The decision to get married reflects for many people a massive error of effective forecasting. German data shows life satisfaction spikes right before marriage and then declines steeply afterward.
He says the graph reliably evokes nervous laughter from audiences.
Because everyone recognizes it. And that's the whole book in one finding. Humans are predictably irrational about the biggest decisions in their lives. Kahneman showed us the patterns. Munger showed us the incentives. Together, they give you the complete map.
And remember how episode 1 opened? Munger's son Teddy dying of leukemia and Munger walking the streets of Pasadena crying.
In this episode, Kahneman's partner Tversky dying at 59 and Kahneman writing a book about human irrationality, Alone.
Both books are about rationality. Both books are haunted by loss. Neither book fully acknowledges the grief that shaped the thinking behind it. Losses loom larger than gains. The man who proved it lived it.
Fact check report. 82 claims verified against primary text and external sources. 13 errors caught and fixed during production. 0 remaining. The full report is on GitHub. You can verify every claim we made today.
Replication scorecard. 6 dead, 5 wounded, 17 plus survived. Read the book, but skip chapters 3 and 4. Everything from part 3 onward is solid.
Shimek's replicability index gives this book an estimated replicability between 12 and 46%. Mean power of cited studies, 46%. Of 13 empirical chapters, only 6 had an R index above 50. Worst chapter, chapter 4 with an R index of 19 out of 100. Best chapter, chapter 24 at 80.
So half the book is built on sand and the other half is granite. And now you know which half is which.
Next episode, Atomic Habits by James Clear. The most famous chart in self-help, the 1% daily improvement compound curve.
It describes a process that has literally never occurred.
70 million copies sold.
See you next time.
Thanks for listening.
And remember, if Daniel Kahneman couldn't escape his own biases, at least check your system 2 is awake before you make a big decision. That's free.